came to Canada in the 1970s to do postgraduate work in archaeology. He has remained in Canada and now lives on Salt Spring Island. His early books grew out of his interest in native civilizations in the Americas, the Aztecs, the Mayas, and the Incas, and later the civilizations of the South Pacific. His first work of fiction, Scientific Romance, was highly acclaimed, and his books, both fiction and nonfiction, have become bestsellers. The outstanding quality of his writing has been recognized by literary awards and by various Book of the Year designations in The Independent, The Sunday Times, and The New York Times. Mr. Wright is a frequent contributor to the Times Literary Supplement and has made radio and television broadcasts in Canada, Britain, and the United States. In 2004, he gave the CBC Massey Lectures, and the book that resulted, A Short History of Progress, won the Libris Nonfiction Book of the Year Award in 2005. Ronald Wright's latest book, which focuses on America, was completed in 2008, just after the Republicans had chosen John McCain as their presidential candidate, but before the Democrats had chosen theirs. Now, whether that's of any significance is another matter. In an interview Mr. Wright gave several years ago, he observed that archaeology is a very good background for the kind of writing that I do. He observed that the value of studying archaeology or history is the perspective it brings when thinking about cultures we live in and reflecting on its strengths, its failings, and its dangers. The topic of tonight's lecture is, What is America? Please welcome our speaker.
Good evening, everyone. I'd like to thank Judge Ann Rawls for her generous introduction, and also thank Peter Nemetz for inviting me here. It's a real pleasure to be back at the Vancouver Institute. I think the last time was about 3 years ago. Before proceeding, though, I should probably apologize to those who came expecting to meet that brooding, dark-haired individual up there. I turned white on George Bush's watch. How's the sound at the back? Is that good? Yeah. Well, I'm sure many of you watched President Barack Obama's inauguration just over a month ago, and it's not my wish tonight to rain on America's parade. The scenes in Washington were enough to bring tears, as my grandma used to say, to a glass eye. After some very, very dark years, American democracy has done exactly what it had to do to begin renewing itself at home and redeeming itself abroad. The United States has indeed voted for change, but it's only prudent for us all to keep this outcome in perspective, to bear in mind why change became so urgent. We shouldn't forget that despite the appalling record of the past 8 years, despite the many mistakes of the Republican campaign and the outstanding political gifts of the winning candidate, the popular vote was still surprisingly close, a spread of only 6%, and it would have been much closer than that without the financial tailspin before Election Day. Close enough, perhaps, for the Republicans to win or to steal. The constituency of the Bush presidency has not gone away. Its supporters still number nearly half the electorate, and I think it was probably the overreach and incompetence of the neoconservatives, as much as their professed ideology, that sank them, thereby opening up political sea room for a change of course. In this sense, it took George Walker Bush to elect Barack Hussein Obama. Despite its economic and political difficulties, the USA is still the world's lone superpower, an informal or hegemonic empire with a military budget greater, by some estimates, than all other nations combined. What America does is everyone's business. Its deeds can still make or break this century. After the flawed presidential election of 2000, the Bush administration took the United States further to the political right than any other major Western country since 1945, a shift that began before the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. Washington's reaction to that tragedy, trampling its own constitution and the Geneva Conventions in an unjust war on terror, squandered solidarity at home and goodwill abroad, provoking a re-examination of the nation's essence. Is America what it thinks it is? Is America what the world has long believed it to be? Well, I hold that the recent difficulties run much deeper than a stolen election and a terrorist assault. The political culture and identity crisis of the United States are best understood as products of the country's past, the real past, not the imaginary one of national myth. The United States is not so much a new Europe across the Atlantic as a unique organism begotten by history's Big Bang, the collision of hemispheres that began when Columbus reached the Caribbean in 1492. Our world descends from the New World surprise that stopped the Spaniards on their way to Asia. Modern America and modern civilization in general are the fruit of a half millennium I call the Columbian Age. 1492 wasn't very long ago. If you're past 50, as I certainly am, you've seen for yourself at least a tenth of the time since Columbus sailed. We're all still living with the consequences, good and bad. Within a few decades of that momentous contact, the wealth, the crops, and later the very land of half a planet, a half that had been developing in isolation for at least 15,000 years, were laid open to the whole. The seed that would become the United States was planted then. Both Adam Smith, the founding thinker of capitalism, and Karl Marx, who founded the alternative persuasion, understood that the gold and silver of Peru and Mexico became the startup capital for the Industrial Revolution. Less dramatic, but more important perhaps, the potato of the Incas, the corn of the Aztecs, and many other American crops set off the human population boom that has now overrun this planet. For Europe and its offshoots, the New World really was an El Dorado, a source of unprecedented wealth and growth. Our political and economic culture, especially its North American variant, has therefore been built on a gold rush mentality of more tomorrow. The American dream of new frontiers and endless plenty has now seduced the world, even communist China. Yet this seduction has triumphed just as the Columbian Age shows many signs of ending, having exhausted the earth and aroused appetites it can no longer feed. In short, the future isn't what it used to be. At the Chicago World's Fair of 1893, the American historian Frederick Jackson Turner gave a seminal talk in which he argued that the United States was forged in the crucible of the frontier. In the mythology embroidered by Hollywood westerns and dime store novels, the frontier is a virgin wilderness tamed by heroic pioneers. The real frontier was a rolling three-century war zone from 1607 until the 1890s, in which the continent violently changed hands. Turner saw that this crucible, which is his word, is the key to understanding American cultural patterns that differ from the European mainstream. The frontier, as he wrote, strips off the garments of civilization, end quote. As white migrants both displaced and absorbed the original Americans, a new culture came into being, a rapacious hybrid dependent on expansion, part European, part indigenous, yet neither. Elements of the old European civilization withered or got left behind. Other elements grew rank in new ways. Isolated and unschooled, the frontier became a breeding ground for militarism, xenophobia, and religious extremism. The aspects of American culture that outsiders, and many Americans, find most alarming today, especially when they converge in government policy, as they did under Ronald Reagan, and again, more strongly, under George W. Bush. The nation didn't wake up one morning and find that it was suddenly imperial. It always has been so. Indeed, George Washington called the United States a rising empire back in 1783. What is now the American homeland was an imperial conquest completed little more than one century ago. And even before the Indian Wars ended at Wounded Knee in 1890, the U.S. was projecting its might into Latin America and across the seas. When American Marines sing from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, they're not boasting idly, but recalling their conquest of Mexico in 1847 and a war with what is now Libya as early as 1801. The New Republic was also a bold and worthy experiment, an attempt to remake Western civilization along ideals of freedom, democracy, and opportunity. The world's best hope, as Thomas Jefferson, its third president, famously said in his inaugural address. Yet the pursuit of that hope relied on a unique and essentially parasitic historical process, the seizing of new territory in which to fulfill it, and on new means as the white man's accelerating technology gave him the upper hand. Seen from within by free citizens, the young United States was indeed a thriving democracy in a land of plenty. Seen from below by its slaves, it was a cruel tyranny, and seen from beyond its effective borders by free native nations and by Mexico, it was a ruthlessly expanding empire. All these stories are true. But if we know only one without the others, what we know is not history, but myth. And such myths are dangerous. From the earliest days, the country has been built on the belief that it's an exception to history and an example to the world. These ideas are rooted in both the Puritans' biblical conceit that they were Latter-day Saints, a chosen people in a promised land, and in the secular dream of the Declaration of Independence, based on the 18th century Enlightenment's faith in the power of reason to build an ideal society. These two visions reinforce each other, but they are, at bottom, incompatible. Theocracy is not democracy. Fundamentalists who think they are carrying out God's orders seldom cast their vote on the basis of hard fact. But both dreams are visions of perfection, whether an Eden given by God or a utopia built by man. Each failure of America's ideals is therefore seen as an anomaly, not a pattern that demands reform. When the realities of power do intrude on the national consciousness, Americans undergo what is called a loss of innocence. This seems to happen about once a generation. As in the Mexican War, the Civil War, the Philippine War, the World Wars, Korea, Vietnam, and lately Afghanistan and Iraq. At least six of those nine wars were started mainly by Americans. During the presidential campaign of 1988, a U.S. warship accidentally shot down an Iranian airliner, killing nearly 300 people on board. The elder George Bush told the press at the time, quote, "I never apologize for the United States of America. I don't care what the facts are," end quote. Well, it's hard To imagine a leading politician of any other Western democracy making such a remark in those circumstances, or, if he did, surviving in politics. Yet only 4 months later, Mr. Bush Sr. was elected president. Innocence is saved by ignorance, by not caring what the facts are, and therefore not learning from them. In his latest book called The Assault on Reason, former Vice President Al Gore, who lost the 2000 general election, though not the popular vote, to the younger George Bush, castigates, quote, the persistent and sustained reliance on falsehoods as the basis of policy, end quote. For Americans such as Gore, the facts do matter. Reason, he underlines, is the true sovereign in the American system. When reason itself comes under attack, American democracy is put at risk, end quote. Well, contrast that view of Al Gore with that of Katherine Harris, the Florida Secretary of State, who did all she could to throw the 2000 vote to Bush and to kill the recount. God, Harris said later, quote, is the one who chooses our rulers, end quote. So this cultural divide between what I call in the book the backwoods America, descended from the Puritans and the frontier hinterland, and Enlightenment America, descended from the intellectual tradition of the founding fathers, was again thrown into sharp relief by this year's presidential election. While Barack Obama acknowledged the Iraq War as a colossal blunder, John McCain's running mate, Sarah Palin, called it a task from God. Well, we'll go back to some earlier tasks of God. In December 1620, the Pilgrims, who were one of several Puritan sects, alighted from the Mayflower at Plymouth Rock. Every American schoolchild learns this nation-founding fact. What they seldom learn is that the Pilgrims were soon accosted there in fluent English by a lonely, grief-stricken Wampanoag, a member of an American people who lived in what are now Rhode Island and eastern Massachusetts. Incidentally, the word American at that time meant Native American, just as Asian and African to this day means indigenous people of those continents. And it's really a measure of the demographic catastrophe that overtook the Native Americans that we now use the word American to mean people who've come in from outside, and we have to say Native American or American Indian or some other unsatisfactory mouthful to refer to these indigenous people. Anyhow, on the face of it, this man, whose name was Squanto, had little reason to be friendly. About 1615, he had been kidnapped in a slave raid on the New England coast, taken to Spain, and sold in the Malaga slave market. At that time, the slave trade was going the other way. This raid was by the English, the Jamestown, from the other colony at Jamestown. And, of course, the Spaniards, as well as the English and other Europeans, had been trying to take Native Americans and sell them in Europe, but found, of course, that they were as vulnerable to Old World disease, or even more vulnerable when taken to the Old World than they were at home. Somehow, Squanto escaped, made his way to England, and returned via Newfoundland to Massachusetts, an amazing journey that took him 4 years. When he got back, he found his hometown, Patuxet, inhabited only by the dead. A plague, most likely smallpox, had struck the New England coast, killing 9 out of 10 in many places, and everyone at Patuxet. Smallpox was terrible enough for Europeans, but because Native Americans had no immunity, they caught it far more easily and suffered more severely. A word of Squanto's town with empty houses, worked fields, and stores of winter corn had reached the Pilgrims during a landfall they'd made at Cape Cod. So they sailed on to Patuxet, renamed it Plymouth, and moved in. Their leader wrote, The good hand of God favored our beginnings by sweeping away great multitudes of the natives that he might make room for us. End quote. Despite the Almighty's favor, about half the would-be settlers died that winter of hunger and scurvy. The Plymouth colonists were mostly townsfolk, traders, and fighters, unskilled on the land. Late December was a bad time to turn up in North America anyway. Once they'd eaten everything in the ghost town of Patuxet, Plymouth, the pilgrims began raiding the country for miles around. The remaining Wampanoags were not a rich source of supply, even at gunpoint. Meanwhile, their western neighbors and traditional foe, the Narragansetts, had avoided the worst of the plague and were threatening the Patuxet region. Probably for this reason, Squanto and other survivors decided to help the newcomers. In the spring, they made peace with the English, teaching them how to grow corn and other American crops, and later how to repay the earth symbolically with the autumn festival of Thanksgiving. The pilgrims thanked their God for saving them in a wilderness, but the feast speaks for itself. Turkey, corn, beans, pumpkin, cranberries, potatoes, and the rest came from thousands of years of New World civilization. It was the heathen, not the Lord, who saved them. The Patuxet pilgrims repaid their native hosts in two ways. In 1622, Squanto and other Wampanoags died in yet another wave of European disease. That was accidental. The second way was clearly intentional. About 1630, William Bradford, a leader of Plymouth, began writing a history of his flock. Although only a decade had passed since the pilgrims' arrival, and the help given by the Wampanoags must still have been fresh in their minds, Bradford didn't care about the facts. What mattered was the myth. This is what he wrote about his flock, referring to them by his own people as they. They had no friends to welcome them, no houses or much less towns to repair to, and these savage barbarians, when they met with them, were readier to fill their sides full of arrows than otherwise. What could they see but a hideous and desolate wilderness, full of wild beasts and wild men? What could now sustain them but the Spirit of God? End quote. Well, this New England contribution to the big lie of an empty North America isn't even internally consistent. How can a desolate wilderness, supposedly without houses or fields, be full of wild men? Yet Bradford's work made its way down through the centuries into other books and has shaped white America's perception of itself ever since. Excuse me. In 1867, Francis Parkman, America's most popular historian of the day, I suppose a man we might compare to Peer Burton, I intend no disrespect to Peer Burton, Parkman wrote, quote, "The Indians melted away, not because civilization destroyed them, but because their own ferocity and intractable indolence made it impossible that they should exist in its presence." End quote. In other words, Indians were not merely unlucky enough to be run over by civilization's advance, but by being both savage and lazy, were actually to blame for their own extermination. Echoes of this blame-the-victim rhetoric would be heard a century later in Vietnam, with the argument that it was necessary to destroy the village or even the country in order to pacify it. As the modern American historian Patricia Limerick wrote recently, quote, "It is no easy matter to distinguish the lessons of the Indian Wars from the lessons of Vietnam," end quote. Well, Hollywood has persuaded us that the only real Indian was a nomadic buffalo hunter. How many of us know that most pre-contact North Americans were farmers living in towns? That the Sioux, the Cheyenne, and many other buffalo hunting peoples were in fact refugees from the invaded East, former corn farmers obliged to take up hunting after their farmland was overrun by whites. How many of us know that the biggest building in North America until the 20th century is an earthen pyramid 10 stories high with a footprint larger than the Great Pyramid of Egypt. And that is one of more than 100 platforms at the ancient city of Cahokia, just outside modern St. Louis. Such things can only be the work of populous, sedentary societies with elaborate social institutions, the type of culture anthropology defines as civilization. White America's trouble was that these so-called Indians didn't always melt away, despite huge population losses. After Native Americans won major military battles in the 1790s, the settler republic's more enlightened minds decided it would be better to share America than fight over it, at least for the time being. Peoples such as the Cherokee accepted Thomas Jefferson's offer to live in peace beside white America as independent nation states on the Euro-American model. Over the next 30 years, they swiftly adopted modern technology and institutions. The Cherokee Nation, to take the most famous example, had its own fixed borders, a written constitution, an assembly and mounted police force, commercial agriculture, even including slavery and cotton plantations, grand brick houses, mills, roads, and a bilingual newspaper. Using a script they had invented for their language, the Cherokees achieved a higher rate of literacy than the United States as a whole at the time. And their status as a sovereign nation was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. But everything changed when backwoods America first came to power under the presidency of the old warhorse Andrew Jackson in the 1830s. The native nations were invaded, uprooted, herded at gunpoint into internment camps, and driven beyond the Mississippi in a death march known as the Trail of Tears. Probably the worst act of what we now call ethnic cleansing ever carried out by a democracy. It was the Indians' very success that doomed them. Not only were they beating the white man at his own game, but they had done the hard work of pioneering, creating a ready-made estate for the so-called pioneers to take over. President Jackson's Indian Removal Act was the leading plank of his election platform for two terms. It was rammed through Congress by a margin of one vote and widely denounced at the time by many leading Americans. Yet Jackson is today honored as a national hero. Many biographies of him don't even mention his Indian policy, and his face adorns the dollar. Even Barack Obama, who in his inaugural address made a point of being inclusive of immigrant races and cultures, forgot to mention the first Americans, a surprising omission from a man who is not only half black, but also partly Cherokee. As we in Canada also know to our shame, it is a very hard thing for a nation built by invaders and intruders to acknowledge, let alone rectify, the moral insecurity of its title to the land. What I'm seeking here is not a list of misdeeds. Every mighty nation has them, including many nations indigenous to the Americas. What I'm tracing is the pattern of such deeds and of their forgetting by the world's one superpower. By the end of the 19th century, the machine guns were rattling everywhere. In British Sudan, French Indochina, the Belgian Congo. And they'd been as genocidal on Argentina's Pampas as on America's Great Plains. The European powers had built empires around the world and were getting ready to carve up China. Having just fulfilled their manifest destiny by conquering their continent, many Americans began to seek a new frontier. Why shouldn't they become overseas empire builders too, before all the best pickings were gone? When President William McKinley took office in 1897, he chose a red-blooded imperialist, Theodore Roosevelt, to be his Assistant Secretary of the Navy and later his Vice President. Roosevelt wrote to a friend at the time, "I should welcome almost any war, for I think this country needs one," end quote. But other leading Americans were uneasy about overseas ambition and keenly aware of the moral danger for a nation that deemed itself the apostle of freedom. Such unlikely bedfellows as the industrialist Andrew Carnegie, the philosopher William James, brother of the novelist Henry James, and a medley of socialists, feminists, church groups, and pacifists came together to form the American Anti-Imperialist League. After the takeover of Hawaii by a white settler coup d'etat, the imperialists' next target became the forgotten remnants of the old Spanish Empire: Cuba, the Philippines, Guam, and a few other islands in the Pacific and Caribbean. Local uprisings in those territories against Spain provided an excuse for American concern. It's now clear that the United States began planning the Spanish War long before a good casus belli could be found, a policy similar in several ways to the hunting of Iraq a century later. But looking back on these events from the far side of the 20th century, one can see the seeds of future war being planted as if by a malevolent fate. Pearl Harbor, the Philippines, Guantanamo, all are famous names today, not for the events of the 1890s, but for those of the 1940s, 1960s, and 2001. In the Philippines, America would learn the limits and costs of imperial reach, as Spain had long before. It was one thing to conquer indigenous Americans and Polynesians who could be expected to melt away from introduced disease and white encroachment, quite another to acquire a large subject population that was biologically a part of Asia. By his own account, President McKinley had cold feet. In 1897, he had spoken out against annexing Cuba because, quote, "by our code of morality, it would be criminal aggression," end quote. But now he wanted the Philippines. How could he justify the inconsistency? Well, McKinley entered into long conversations with God about this moral dilemma. Obligingly, the Lord told the president it was nothing less than America's duty, quote, "to educate the Filipinos and uplift and civilize and Christianize them," end quote. Greed had to be dressed up as a hallowed duty to bring the savage into civilization. Senator Albert Beveridge, the chief ideologue of the imperialists in Congress, argued that God had been preparing Anglo-Saxons and other Germanic folk, quote, "for 1,000 years as the master organizers of the world, and of all our race he has marked the American people as his chosen nation," end quote. Again, it's the old language of Puritan fanatics. In his speech called "In Support of an American Empire," Beveridge told Congress, quote, "the Philippines are ours forever, and just beyond the Philippines are China's illimitable markets. We will not retreat from either. We will not renounce our part in the mission of our race, trustee under God of the civilization of the world," end quote. One senator declared that letting the Filipinos keep the freedom they had won would be the highest cruelty. Another said, "America need not shrink from imperialism because hers would be the imperialism of liberty." Whatever his reasons, McKinley wanted the Philippines just as badly as George W. Bush wanted Iraq. Words written by the American historian Tyler Dennett back in 1922 could easily apply to either war. This is what Dennett wrote, quote, "the policy was adopted in great ignorance of the actual facts and in a blissful and exalted assumption that any race ought to regard conquest by the American people as a superlative blessing," end quote. Well, it took 60,000 U.S. troops 2 years to confer that blessing and capture the Filipino leader. From the scanty reports that leaked out between 1899 and 1901, it's clear that, in cruelty and in injustice, the Philippine War reprised the Indian Wars and foretokened many others. William James said, "McKinley's cant has reached perfect expertness in the art of killing silently." The Anti-Imperialist League did what it could to break the silence by publishing soldiers' letters. One officer wrote home, quote, "The town of Caloocan, near Manila, contained 17,000 inhabitants. The 20th Kansan swept through it, and now Caloocan contains not one living native," end quote. When journalists at last got to the war zone, they confirmed the worst, including use of a torture that is again in the news today as waterboarding. "Our men," reported the Philadelphia Ledger, "have killed to exterminate men, women, children, and prisoners. Our soldiers have pumped salt water into men to make them talk," end quote. Meanwhile, in Washington, the Secretary of War, Elihu Root, stonewalled the critics. "The war in the Philippines," he said, "has been conducted by the American Army with scrupulous regard for the rules of civilized warfare, with self-restraint, and with a humanity never surpassed," end quote. Well, many of you probably remember Donald Rumsfeld, Elihu Root's modern successor, using that very same word, humanity, to describe his bombing of Iraq. In 1997, Dick Cheney, Jeb Bush, George W.'s brother, and others who would surface in or near the future Bush administration founded what they called the Project for a New American Century. Its agenda was to assert U.S. hegemony by both the threat and use of arms, and to roll back the peace dividend, the reduction in weapons spending expected after the end of the Cold War. In January 1998, this group sent a letter to President Clinton urging him, quote, "to aim above all at the removal of Saddam Hussein's regime from power," end quote. The letter's signatories included Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and Richard Pearl, all of whom became leading members of Bush's staff. Most had long-standing ties, directorships, and holdings in the weapons, military supply, and oil businesses, as did Cheney, the former CEO of Halliburton, and Condoleezza Rice, a former Chevron executive. Indeed, an oil tanker called the Condoleezza Rice had to be discreetly renamed when she went on the public payroll. The world was dragooned to war in Iraq on false pretenses. George Bush knew it, informed opinion around the world knew it, and so did Bush's most pliant ally, Tony Blair. Millions protested in the streets of the world's great cities, including a large demonstration in New York, where Al-Qaeda had struck only 18 months before. The banners in the streets saying, "No blood for oil," were dismissed as cant by Bush and Blair. But we now know better. Alan Greenspan, the head banker of the United States government throughout most of Bush's tenure, recently confirmed that the Iraq War was, and these are Greenspan's words, "largely about oil." Like the Philippine War, the Korean War, and Vietnam, the Iraq War was wrongly foretold by its mongers to be quick and easy. As everyone now knows, the war was won, but the peace lost, the entire region destabilized. The consequences to world peace and prosperity are still unfolding. The damage to human rights and to the moral standing of the United States has been incalculable. Ancient freedoms, such as habeas corpus, a cornerstone of English-speaking democracy for 1,000 years, were casually brushed aside. Ever since the initial attack on Afghanistan, the Bush regime violated Geneva Conventions on the treatment of war prisoners that even Nazi Germany had observed. Guantanamo Bay, in eastern Cuba, only 1 hour's flight from Miami, was merely the most visible gulag in an archipelago of offshore prisons where men and boys were held without charge, trial, or access to lawyers for years. The full extent of these abuses is still unknown, but they certainly include torture, solitary confinement, and degradation of the sort that came to light at Abu Ghraib, the infamous prison near Baghdad. The methods allowed in Bush's war on terror gave all repressive regimes of both right and left an excuse for their own atrocities. Vladimir Putin sang the anti-terrorist song as he steered Russia back to autocracy. The Castro brothers savored the irony that Washington kept its prison camp in Cuba to escape the reach of U.S. law. And, of course, those who stood to gain most from the war on terror were the terrorists themselves. Looking back, as I just have, and this is a selective view, of course, at the record of the United States on its own continent and various parts of Asia, it may seem hard to grasp how the nation built up a moral standing to lose in the first place. But it did, and deservedly so, in the first half of the 20th century. Between the Philippines and Vietnam came the World Wars, two acts in a long, mad, mainly European tragedy that began in 1914 and ended in 1945. The United States did not start those wars, tried to stay out of them, but eventually intervened decisively for the greater good. Not only that, after both wars, America, led by the Enlightenment half of its divided soul, tried to build a new international order based on cooperation, arbitration, worldwide institutions, and development. The phrase New World Order was coined by Woodrow Wilson in 1919 when he founded the League of Nations. Wilson's League failed. His own country, to his great sorrow, never joined it. But from its ashes would grow the United Nations and the European Union. The tragedy of American diplomacy since 1914 is that the United States did learn the lessons of history in the first half of the 20th century and then forgot them, or rather tore them up, in the second. Those lessons, which cost at least 80 million lives, were political, social, and economic. By 1945, the world had learned that if it didn't want more terrorists, more anarchists, Bolsheviks, Nazis, great wars, and great depressions, it could not return to the laissez-faire chariot race that had crashed in 1914. Certain rules of justice had to be universally observed. Social order had to become reasonably fair, both within nations and among them. Imperialism had to be replaced by multilateralism. International institutions with real clout had to be built up. Capitalism had to be managed to avoid mass exploitation, mass unemployment, and extremes of wealth and misery. America, notably under Franklin D. Roosevelt's presidency in the 1930s and 1940s, used its might and its money to these ends, adopting the ideas of the economist John Maynard Keynes for crafting the New Deal and smoothing out the boom-bust ride of free markets. Well, simply put, Keynesianism argued that government should save during the good times and spend during the bad. It didn't always work and was subject to temptations and abuses, but no one has yet had a better idea. The Second World War economies had shown that planning worked, that government provision of jobs and basic needs could eliminate the underclass. Keynes had found a balance between capitalism and socialism. Even Britain, bombed, broke, and rationed, saw a steady improvement in nutrition and health throughout the war and a narrowing gap between rich and poor. Almost all Western democracies used their wartime experience to build modern welfare states along Keynesian lines in the 1940s and 1950s. Well, that time, the mid-20th century, was the high watermark of American prestige, the moment at which the United States, admired for bravery in war and generosity in peace, really was the world's best hope. But that promise was poisoned by the excesses of the Cold War, which included not only McCarthyite witch hunts and a rampant arms race, but the American overthrow of freely elected governments in Iran, Guatemala, Chile, and other places. President Eisenhower's famous warning against the anti-democratic power of what he dubbed the military-industrial complex was amply borne out. And we should remember that Eisenhower was a Republican, although moderate enough that some members of McCarthy's camp believed that he was a tool of the world communist conspiracy. The far right took advantage of Cold War paranoia to unpick the New Deal politically and economically. Under Ronald Reagan and both Bushes, America turned away from the future and back to the archaic political, economic, and cultural patterns of the 19th century and the backwoods frontier. Instead of building international structures, increasingly extreme Republican administrations set about undermining them, pulling out of the Law of the Sea Treaty, the Convention on Biological Diversity, the Kyoto Accords and other environmental measures, various weapons ban treaties, and the International Criminal Court, most of which had enjoyed initial American support. Like the first President Bush, too many American voters didn't care about the facts. Too many opted for the snake oil of Reaganomics and the fast food of the national myth instead of the sobering nourishment of history. Repeatedly seduced by the drumbeat of militarism, nationalism, exceptionalism, and fundamentalism, America became an unreliable member of the world community. Well, that neoconservative project, which culminated in the George W. Bush regime, now lies everywhere in ruins. A new president has inherited the wreckage. Two wars, so easily started, so difficult to end, a trampled constitution, international disgrace, and the worst economic crisis since the 1930s. As the Onion put it in their headline of November the 5th last year, black man is given the worst job in the world. Millions flocked to Barack Obama's inauguration in Washington. Hundreds of millions watched from their homes around the world. Emotion ran high, a blend of hope and relief, inspiration and schadenfreude. Hello to President Obama was also good riddance to President Bush, who, while outwardly gracious in departure, used his last weeks of power before the January handover to pursue his assault on the environment by a flurry of executive decrees. Many in the throng booed loudly whenever the outgoing president was mentioned by name, and the BBC World News showed Dick Cheney, who had hurt his back, scuttling away from the halls of power in a wheelchair like a superannuated Dr. Strangelove, black leather gloves and all. The American democracy, which is so dependent on the qualities of its leader that in some ways it resembles an elective monarchy, is indeed lucky that a president has emerged who seems to have what it will take to tackle the domestic and international crises. Moments of great ruin are also chances for great change, and it's here that progressive forces in America and the outside world have pinned their hopes. It's still too soon to know what can and will be done. One thing we can be fairly sure of is that the needs are so pressing and the expectations so high that there are bound to be disappointments. many will recall similar times of hope for change, notably the euphoria less than 20 years ago when the Berlin Wall came down, the Cold War ended, and America elected another charismatic Democrat, Bill Clinton, who, partly for reasons of his own making, did not live up to that historic opportunity. However, the new administration has got off to a good start, helped by a wide Democratic margin in the House of Representatives, though a smaller one in the Senate. Mr. Obama healed the rift in his own party by appointing Hillary Clinton and other establishment Democrats to high office. In his choice of advisors and heads of federal agencies, Obama has restored intelligence and science, especially environmental science, to positions of influence. His controversial decision to keep Robert Gates on as defense secretary may prove wise in winding down the Iraq War and finding a fresh approach to Afghanistan. Robert Gates is no Donald Rumsfeld. And Obama has announced a phased withdrawal of combat troops from Iraq by the end of August 2010, leaving rather a large number of support troops in place until the end of the following year. On his first day in the White House, Obama announced the closure within a year of the Guantanamo Bay prison camp. And in his first address to Congress just a few days ago, he underlined that the United States does not torture. On the economic front, Obama has self-consciously assumed the mantle of Franklin Roosevelt, naming the first phase of his financial stimulus plan the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, language evoking the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933, FDR's launching pad for the New Deal. In the 2009 budget presented to Congress, with expenditures of $3.6 trillion, nearly half of which must be borrowed, Obama fulfilled an election promise by announcing that taxes for the richest Americans, defined as those earning more than $250,000 a year, will rise, while the other 95% of taxpayers will receive tax cuts. Large sums have been allotted to public works, healthcare, and education. To help pay for these initiatives, the problem here, of course, is that we're starting to practice Keynesianism in the bad times, not having saved for Keynesianism during the good. To help pay for these initiatives, which will be very hard to do, Obama proposes reining in extravagances such as needless farm subsidies and unworkable weapon systems, vowing to cut the federal deficit in half within 4 years. Around the world, there has already been an Obama effect, as governments who've been trying to deal with the environmental and social crises, especially climate change, poverty, and banking reform, now see an America willing to join instead of hinder their efforts. Most of Bush's firmest allies and fellow travelers, Britain's Blair, Spain's Aznar, Australia's Howard, had already been voted out when Obama came to power. Those still standing, among them Stephen Harper, have become political dinosaurs, with no choice but to adapt or go extinct. The G20 group of leading nations has made it clear that deregulated hyper-capitalism, also known as Anglo-Saxon capitalism after the Reagan-Thatcher axis of the 1980s, is dead and must be replaced with something resembling the Keynesian consensus of the mid-20th century. Well, I need hardly point out how much the world has changed since then. But that said, the lessons of the two world wars, that the only way forward for civilization is a middle way combining the better features of both socialism and capitalism, those lessons are more cogent than ever. Nobody yet knows how serious the financial collapse will prove to be, nor how long it may last. The opinions of the so-called experts who fostered this mess must be treated with the utmost skepticism. As Adam Smith noted long ago, money is belief. When that collective illusion is abused. Prosperity vanishes almost as quickly as fraudsters fleeing in their private jets to South America. Only time will tell whether an economic recovery will take root within a year or two, as optimists claim, or whether the capitalist order is now disintegrating as profoundly as the communist order did 20 years ago. Of particular concern is the stability of China, whose authoritarian regime has survived mainly by delivering rapid economic growth dependent on exports. If the promise of modernity evaporates in the world's most populous nation, so may the legitimacy of the Beijing elite. The same is true of many smaller and less important countries, several of which are already sliding into anarchy or achieving the unenviable state of failed states. Unlike 20 years ago, let alone 60 years ago, the health of the natural world, which is the sole root of the economic world, is now frailer than at any time since civilization began. Nothing short of a massive international effort in which the wealthy nations of the European Union and the United States take the lead, will be equal to the threats and challenges we have all ignored too long. After too many lost decades and lost opportunities, the United States should be congratulated for electing a government that has declared itself ready to take up the avoided yet unavoidable task. But I shall end by underlining something I said in the last chapter of my book, that while those of us in the outside world may hope for progressive American leadership, we cannot afford to rely on it. Internationalism and anything smacking of socialism are anathema to about half the American people. It is indeed encouraging that during Obama's first weeks, 2 in every 3 Americans approve of their new president. But this is still the honeymoon. If history is any guide, the right will harden and regroup, especially when problems at home and abroad prove expensive or intractable. Many in the United States will be as keen to thwart the policies of Barack Obama as they were to undo the work of FDR. In his inaugural speech, President Obama called upon Americans, quote, to begin again the work of remaking America, end quote. Words that acknowledge past failings and future burdens. It behoves us all not merely to salute, but to engage with the return of enlightenment America to the world, and to help it endure, not least for our own good. Thank you all very much.
We'll probably take a few questions here and then go to the other room. We're going to take a few questions here and then we'll go to the overflow room. Would you? All right. Let's see. Yes.
How do you explain? Wasn't an American, in fact, has embraced some legitimacy.
The question is how do I explain Tony Blair's policy, his embrace of George Bush's policies? It's a very good question, and it's not one to which I'm sure I have a good answer. But I think that at the beginning, after the attacks of 9/11, when Blair sprang to America's side, that was the right thing to do. I think it was extremely important at that time for the United States to know that its allies were absolutely with it. But it is the going into Iraq that is the great mystery. There seems to have been absolutely nothing that Blair could get out of that. And there were plenty of, you know, Americans perhaps can be excused for being rather naive about the Middle East, and particularly about Iraq. But Britain doesn't have that excuse because it's the former colonial power. And there were plenty of old duffers in London clubs who could have told Tony Blair that it was a very bad idea to destabilize that country, odious though Saddam Hussein's regime certainly was. Part of Tony Blair's problem, I think, is that he, as he himself admitted, he doesn't read history. I think he also had an exaggerated, and this is a deep-seated cultural problem of the British, an exaggerated notion of what the British call the special relationship with America, which is something that most Americans haven't heard of. So, we in Canada think we have a special relationship too. And then there was, I think, some shared values, religious values. Another theory, and it's only a theory that I've heard, is that Blair felt he owed Bush for shutting down American sources of funding for Irish terrorists in Northern Ireland. And another theory I've heard, and again, it's only something I've heard, is that Blair thought that by becoming a very close ally of the United States, he would enhance his clout in dealing with the European Union. In fact, of course, the Iraq War was a disaster. It split the European Union to the great delight and joy of the American right, who considers the European Union a kind of communist state in masquerade. I'm afraid those are all the answers I have. It's a mystery.
Yes.
30 years ago, I read a headline.
The questioner said that he read a few years ago a headline saying that America would be a have-not country by 2020, and do I have a comment on that? Well, at the moment, it looks like we're all going to be have-not country by... I mean, really, we don't know. It depends how serious this economic crisis is. One thing that is clear, though, is that America's economic clout, regardless of whether the world economy prospers or declines, America's share of the world economy has been slowly declining since the Second World War. In 1945, the United States had slightly more than half of the whole world's industrial output. And today, it's somewhere around a quarter or maybe even a fifth. The other thing to remember is that the European Union, sort of imperfect and fuzzy institution though it is, has a greater population and a bigger economy than the United States, collectively. The cost of maintaining an empire in the manner that the United States has tried to do it is ruinous, as many other empires have found before. I would say it's pretty certain that America's economic clout will decline, continue to decline, which will eventually mean a decline in military clout as well. Whether it'll become a have-not nation, I mean, I think we should not forget that there's still about 50 times, we in these countries consume 50 times more per capita than, say, people of Bangladesh, and it'd be an awfully long time before America sinks to that level.
We're going to go to the overflow room now, and if you just sit tight, but also if you would be quiet, because of the system, people in the other room would not be able to hear, and you won't be able to hear the questions. So if you could be quiet and just sit tight, we'll be back shortly. Now, are there some questions here? Yes.
and on the public good, I suppose you would call it. I certainly have a lot of respect for that book and used it as a very useful resource. And he's covered a lot of the same ground, not quite, as you say, not in the same way. I think really that he's just trying to do a different thing, which is focus very much on the working class in America and how it's been exploited. Although he does cover some of the early exploitation and dispossession and killing of the indigenous people. Another very fine book in that regard would be Francis Jennings's The Invasion of America, which is particularly good on that early history of Eastern North America. And then there are many books, of course, on the Indian removal by Jackson. I think Howard Zinn's book is an excellent book, and I would urge everybody to read it. I was trying to do two things in my book, and one of them was reaching beyond the United States to look at how it was really the European takeover of the whole new world that created the modern world, and the United States is the beneficiary of that process. And I don't think that has been adequately treated by other historians in the past, not that I'm aware of anyway. And to show really how we've now reached an impasse where this mentality of constant expansion can't go on. I think a socialist perspective such as Zinn's is very valuable in pointing out, I mean, socialism has the advantage over capitalism that it is, in theory at any rate, does not depend on infinite expansion, because there is a sense that there's so much to go around and it should be shared. And you could get away with this illusion that the pie is always going to get bigger and everybody will eventually win the lottery when everything is expanding. But we now know, of course, that the age of imperial expansion is long over, and the age of the expansion of the human economy may well be over, and the expansion of the human population and consumption just cannot continue the way it is. We have to reach a stable condition, and that inevitably will mean sharing if it's not going to mean people fighting over for what's left.
Any other questions? Yes.
You're thinking of institutions such as the UN?
And,
the question is, can we use the existing international institutions to move forward? And yeah, I think we can. I think that Obama actually has already indicated that the United States will start paying its full dues at the UN and will get behind the UN, particularly in dealing with poverty. I think that there's certainly need for reform at the UN, for a reconsideration of how the Security Council is constituted and things like that. But it is the only formal international institution that we have, and that we would be very foolish to try and scrap it. I also think, though, that that the European Union offers a sort of model of how people can sort of voluntarily join. I mean, after all, it started as six nations and is now, I think at last count, 27 or something like that. That nations can kind of join into a body that is more than a trading bloc, but not quite a federation, and which aims for a balance between the interests of business, the environment, and labor. So I think the European Union is a fruitful model, not necessarily to that the European Union itself should sort of engross the world, but that other bodies along those lines would be useful, because they offer an alternative to imperialism, an alternative to one powerful nation telling everybody else what to do. And there have been very few of those alternatives in history. And then there are other things like the World Bank. Remember that the World Bank, although it became a tool of monetarism and oppression of the poor during the Reagan and Thatcher years. The World Bank was, in fact, one of Keynes's ideas and was founded by FDR and Keynes with the intent of making money available to for development and to even out the boom-bust cycle and the gap between rich and poor. And there's no reason at all why the World Bank can't return to that remit.
We're going back to the other room now. To hear the balance of the questions.
The problem started with Robert McIntyre.
There are seats in the other room. Now, are there questions in this group? Yes.
The question is, are there any lessons for Canada about what's gone wrong and what's gone right in the United States? Well, yes, certainly, I think so, in both counts. I mean, I think in terms of what's gone wrong, you know, we have a lot of skeletons in our closet. It may not be quite as bad in some areas, but our policy towards the First Peoples of this land is, however we may think it was a little kinder and gentler, the end result has been much the same. And there has, in fact, been more. There was more violence, more fighting than is generally acknowledged in Canadian history. We are guilty of believing our own myths. I mean, just recently they've been celebrating the foundation of Montreal and Quebec City in the province of Quebec. And I mean, that is only the foundation by Europeans. Those two towns were already there, and they were seen by Jacques Cartier, who kidnapped some of their inhabitants, and they were large towns with triple stockades and thousands of people living in them. So they certainly were not founded by Europeans. And also, though, I think that we should be encouraged by, I think we often feel that there is so much inertia that we cannot make sweeping reforms. I think we should be encouraged by the energy with which this new administration has announced that it will make sweeping reforms. Of course, we have yet to see whether it will be possible to carry them out. But there is certainly, you know, in a sense we are, I don't want to keep to compare us too directly to the United States, because I think one of the things that sets Canada apart is that we have much stronger ties with Europe and other countries in Asia and places such as Australia. And we did not break away from the metropolitan power in the 18th century. We departed much more peacefully in the 19th century, and that's made an enormous difference and prevented that growth of a sort of militaristic, xenophobic frontier culture to the same extent in this country. I think that's one of the things that made a huge difference. But at the same time, we share this continent. We are closely integrated economically. We speak the same language. And, of course, there are things we can learn, both the positive lessons and the negative ones.
Yes, sir.